Welcome to In Their Own Words, the audio memories of leading members of the British Tennis Journalists Association. In this edition, honorary member John Barrett, former Grand Slam player, correspondent of the Financial Times, and the voice of Wimbledon on BBC television, revisits some of his favourite memories, including commentating on the remarkable 1980 men's singles final between Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe. John, the Financial Times started in 1963. At the time, you were heavily involved in so many other things. How did it come about that you were asked to write for the Financial Times?
Well, I had a call from Jeff Owen, who was the editor at the time, and he was an old friend, an old tennis opponent. And so he said, would I consider doing some tennis stories for the FT? And I said, well, that sounds very interesting. Yes, please. So I did, and that's when it started, 63.
And did that involve travelling overseas at that point, John? Were you mainly doing at home?
Well, of course, I was travelling overseas because I was working then for Slazenges, and it meant that I was at all the major tournaments. And so I could combine the two jobs, working for Slazenges with rackets and for the players and all the other equipment they needed, and writing for the FT.
And who was with you on the circuit at that point in terms of the writers?
Oh, all our friends like Frank Rostron, of course, who lives near me in Wimbledon. So we used to see a bit of each other. Laurie Pignon, they were the two I suppose I would see most of the time. Lance Tingay, of course, was another who lived in Wimbledon. So, you know, they were the stalwarts, if I can call them that, of the press room.
And how did you juggle the fact that you had the bad boys going on the LTA squad? We're still in 66, you reached the Wimbledon quarterfinals of the mixed doubles again. And also you had your Slazenges work. How did you juggle it all with the FT?
Well, it wasn't easy. I had to stay up quite late sometimes to do my writing. But being there at the site every time on the overseas ones made it relatively easy to get all the information I needed, but it was finding the writing time that was difficult. So it was early mornings and late nights.
So did you carry a typewriter with you?
I had one of those, what were they called, those little computers that we had, the first ones. I can't remember their name now, but they were a sort of grey colour, and I bought it in America and worked on that all the time. Then I had to learn how to use the internet, which wasn't easy.
And you also contribute a Wimbledon crossword.
Yes, so that's right.
For the how many years were you doing that, John? Do you still do it?
Well, I can't remember now when it started, but I did about 15 years of that. It was fun. I've always enjoyed doing crosswords, and I'm enjoying Wordle now at the moment. Are you enjoying Wordle?
Now, in terms of the BBC, 1971, Dan Maskell, the voice of Wimbledon, now a new voice of Wimbledon. How did that come about, John?
Well, I was invited by the BBC just at the time when, about the player boycott period, 73, wasn't it? And I had a phone call from the director of sport for the BBC at the time, and he asked me if I would like to do commentary at Wimbledon. I said, well, I'd love to. And we did a few trial broadcasts at Bournemouth. That was the first thing I did for them during the hardcore championships down there. Then it went from there.
And in terms of your great matches, of course, you were the voice for the Borg-McEnroe 1980 final. Did you at the time understand that this was going to be something that would go into the history books? I mean, what was it like? Was there great anticipation in the commentary box as you were preparing for that 1980 final?
Well, I think we were all looking forward to every Wimbledon final we ever do. Obviously, it is the pinnacle of the sport. So that particular one, 1980, I think we realised it was going to be a real tussle, but we didn't realise quite what a tussle it would become. And we had a convention at the time. BBC commentators were asked for the lead commentator to leave the tie breaks in a match to the colour commentator. So I was the colour commentator to Dan's lead. And when we got to that famous tie break, the 1816 one, or 1917, in the fourth set, I was to do it by myself, which I did. And I was given help to keep count of the number of match points there were in there and the number of break points, because they mounted up considerably fast. So that was fun. Yes, I think that was a special match for the reason of that particular tiebreak, and because in the final set, Borg became the phenomenal server. In the first game of the final set, he was 15-40 down on his serve, came back, held, and lost only one more point on his serve in the entire match. That tells you how powerful his serve was then.
Do you have a favourite player, men and women, that you watch?
Well, I think over the years, one enjoys all the great players' performances. I used to love watching Monica Seles playing so well from the back of the court. Her tussles with Steffi Graf, the final in Australia, I think it was 81, was an absolutely brilliant one, when they were both slugging it out. And Graf, in fact, had to serve and volley a bit to come in and prevail. But I suppose you look for the technical qualities in a player and the way they disport themselves on the court to become favourites of the crowd. I mean, Federer is a prime example of this. How many years has he won that title, the public's favourite player, a ballot for that title run by ATP every year? I mean, he won it year after year. You get to appreciate the qualities that they show as complete human beings, not just the tennis player. But that's why I think Federer is so popular. He is a wonderful human being, and he is very conscious of the crowd's reaction to what he's doing, and takes care to make sure that he keeps his image bright.
We are obsessed now with statistics in tennis. Your BP yearbook, which you started and then became the World of Tennis, how did you get that going, John? Because it's so many statistics to be drawn at a time where there was no sort of computerized statistics.
Yes, that was interesting. In fact, it was my colleagues in the press room at the time who, in 1967, knowing that open tennis was probably going to come next year, because we had that year the professional tournament on the centre court at Wimbledon, which precipitated the vote to have open tennis the next year. So at the time, they all said to me, look, you've got time to do this. Compile a book for us with all the results in. And I was persuaded to do it, and I did it. And it was the first couple of years, I think it was called the BP Yearbook of World Tennis, because BP, and I was running the junior program for BP at the time, the Junior Tennis Fellowship, they were prepared to sponsor it. So that's what happened. And yes, it was a sort of labor of love that became a bit of a tyrant, because I never had a proper Christmas or New Year. That was the time when the weight of copy coming in and all the material to put the book together was pouring in. And I promised Angela in the end, after about 25 years, that I'd give it up so that I could have a Christmas with her properly.
And in terms of getting that information, were some Grand Slams better than others in letting you have the information? Did some of them guard their information or not? How is Wimbledon?
No, they were very cooperative. The Grand Slams were the least problem. The biggest problem was getting the ranking lists out of the nations. And I had the addresses of all the nations, federations or associations, and would write to them and have to chivvy them several times before I got them to make the list of, and I'm afraid the lists are not totally complete, because one or two never did send their ranking lists. So then I would ask colleagues in the press room to write the various stories of the important events that we could have space to cover, and waited for their contributions. And they were very good. I mean, David Gray was particularly good, because he loved that sort of thing. And of course, became the Secretary of the International Tennis Federation. So
people like David Irvin enjoyed statistics, didn't they? David was always one for good statistics.
Absolutely right. Yes, they did. And Lance was the man I turned to at the start to bring in the list of results and patiently typed them out. He was a very patient man. That's how we put it all together. But it was always a bit of a jigsaw. A nice story for you. I had a very nice story that I commissioned from Bill Edwards for the first open tournament in the world at Bournemouth, 1968. And when we were putting the book together on my dining room table at home, helped by Peter West, who was then doing the biographies of the players, I'm afraid we couldn't find space. We were having to cut down the number of stories or results. We didn't have space for Bill's lovely article on the first open tennis in the world. I mean, what an error that was, leaving that story out. The results are there, but not the story. And I had to apologize to Bill the next year profusely because he'd done a nice piece.
The official history of Wimbledon is very much associated with yourself. Again, a massive amount of work for the official history.
Absolutely. I suppose I spent about 4 years compiling that in all. But again, I was persuaded by my friends at the club to do an official history because there hadn't been one. There had been stories of the championships a lot, but not involving the club as well. And I was asked to do a book that would combine the two and got on with it. And I think it was about 1985, the first edition. It's called 100 Wimbledon's A Celebration, which I'm afraid, because the proofreading occurred at the time when I was away at the French Championships and didn't get sent the final proofs, there are some errors in there. And we had to, when we launched it, at the club, rather embarrassingly, there was a fairly long errata page, which we had to include because you couldn't let the book loose without showing people that you realised there had been a few mistakes.
And in terms of looking back, John, the characters that you enjoyed amongst the press, are there a couple that really stand out? You mentioned Lance Tingay, David Gray. I suppose Laurie Pignon would be a real character?
Yes, he was. And he was a member at Wimbledon, of course, so I used to see quite a lot of him in his later years. He would come and have lunch there and we'd have a chuckle over a few things that had happened in our lives jointly. I got on so well with everybody in the press room, so they were all my friends and still are those still alive, like yourself. I mean, we used to have some laughs, didn't we?
Very much so.
I used to do my horse invitation for you. I'm not going to do it now, though.
In all your tennis achievements on court, leading the press to victory over the Americans, I assume, looking at the picture, that you're a tennis player. Jerry looks quite tennis player-ish, but quite honestly, the rest of your team don't look particularly strong. How good was the British tennis team?
For the standard of play that we were trying to achieve, they were good. And they were all casual players, amateur players, obviously. Well, we were all amateurs then, weren't we? The fun was in all the mishaps that happened and the stories you would hear afterwards about the terrible call they got when they were 5-4 up at the first, you know, these stories. And we used to, of course, enjoy a jar or two afterwards together. And it was a very competitive at the time, very competitive on the court, but afterwards it was all fun and games and chat, and there we were still enjoying the game as players.
And John, what has kept your enthusiasm going for tennis throughout the years? What is it? Is it just an absolute love of the sport?
I think it is. I mean, I've often asked myself that. How is it that I got so involved in the sport and went on with it for so long? It was because I love it. And as a child, I had been the ball boy for my father in the park because every weekend, Saturday or Sunday, it varied, he and three friends, the same four all the time, would go to Mill Hill Park and I would be the ball boy. And at the end of the game, they would spend 5 minutes hitting the ball with me. And then the wonderful day came when I was allowed actually to play. I don't know, I was about 7 or 8. And I played a couple of games and, you know, was charging across the net, trying to knock off a volley or two. And it enthused me for the sport itself. So I used to haunt the park with a local friend. And we would persuade the park keeper to let us onto the court when we didn't have any money to play, and we talked our way on and played there. It was such fun, and seeing your improvement was the thrill too. And I eventually sort of started entering junior tournaments, managed to win a few. I won the Middlesex Junior Championships in doubles first, and so the schoolboy championships at Queen's too. And so the success bred further interest in it, and it became an obsession.